Desana on the 1st of June, 1979. The term Machima, or suitability, refers to the application of the Dhamma weapon to encounter and overwhelm any kind of kilesa that might appear. When the strength of this Dhamma weapon matches the strength of the kilesas, then one can withstand them. But there is still the possibility of the kilesas overwhelming and defeating us. But if we are heavy-handed and a lot more forceful than the kilesas, then they will steadily diminish. One will come to see the result, which will testify to the efficacy of one's exertion at this level. Using this particular kind of machima as the means of countering with the kilesas, one will now take up this particular method of practice as the means of treading the path in the future. One must steadily and constantly be doing the work of the suppressing and eradicating of the kilesas. When the kilesas become steadily weakened, the application of the Machima Dhamma will be automatically adjusted to the intensity of the kilesas. When the kilesas are violent and vehement, then the machima must be equally forceful and vigorous. One must really stand on one's ground and fight to the death. One must not retreat one step or back down. One must not abandon or let go of one's sati and panya, which is the foremost and the principal weapon, such as during the time when dukkha vetana appears within the body due to sitting for a long time. There will be a lot of pain in the various parts of the body, which becomes more intense and severe. It will yield no result or benefit if we merely endure this dukkha vetana. We must use our endurance and perseverance in our contention and in our struggle. We have to investigate with sati and panya. Panya will have to dig and search, probe and analyze for the truth of the dukkha vetana that is appearing at that time. By constantly having sati controlling and directing the work of panya, both of these factors must be relentlessly performing their work. One has to investigate to see where this vetana arises. It will be unavoidable that there will be the presumption and assumption that vetana arises from any one particular part of the body. For instance, at the knee, around the waist, or at the bottom, or at the thighs, around the pelvis, or at any other particular part. Whichever part seems to be most profoundly affected by this dukkha vetana is where we have to focus our sati and panya. One has to examine and find out what the cause of this dukkha vetana is, which is appearing at this point. What is it that is being afflicted with dukkha? Is it the flesh? Or is it the skin? Or the sinews? Or the bones at this particular point? One has to examine the flesh and then compare it with vetana. One must find out if they are one and the same thing. Are they similar to one another? The flesh has a physical appearance and characteristic, but dukkha vedana does not have that physical appearance and characteristic. It only manifests its nature of pain and agony naturally. This is the way of differentiating them, so that one can see them clearly as they are. This work of differentiating must depend on sati to do the directing and the concentrating on the work of panya. That is doing the examination and probing into the nature of dukkha vedana and the nature of the flesh. Then one's understanding, perception, and comprehension of this truth can be consistent and continuous. One must not relent in the application of one's sati and panya, as they must always go together in a pair, as they do the investigation into all of the sabhava dhammas, like vedana and the flesh. If we want to separate the bones out for investigation, and if there are aches and pains in the bone, and we have the understanding that this bone is being afflicted by dukkha, we must then concentrate our attention in looking at this dukkha until we can see it very clearly. Then we have to look at the bone itself to see what kind of characteristic it has. For the bones have distinct characteristics, features, and colors. But this dukkha has no such feature. It is simply dukkha, similar to the dukkha that we have alleged to be arising from the flesh. It is just presumption to think that the flesh is being afflicted with dukkha. Whether it is the dukkha of the skin, the flesh, or of the bones, it is always of one characteristic nature. But this skin, flesh, and bones are all made up of different things and characteristics. How can they be vedana? Let's consider when a person is dead. The bones, the flesh, and the sinews and skin all still remain. But there is no dukkha. If they are one and the same thing, why is there no dukkha in a dead person, in spite of the fact that the skin, the flesh, the sinews, and the bones are still there? If this is the case, how can we consider them to be one and the same thing? This is one aspect. The second aspect deals with the citta, which is terribly important. We must now separate the citta and look into it. Is the citta afflicted with dukkha? If it is not any single part of the body that is being afflicted with dukkha, then is it the citta that is being so afflicted? We have to look at the citta and at vedana, and also at the body, to see how they are different from one another. All the citta has is just knowingness. Whether dukkha arises, remains, or disappears, this knowingness is still there. Even before this dukkha arose, this knowingness was still there. If the dukkha is the citta, and the citta is dukkha, then when dukkha disappears, the citta must also disappear. The citta should not remain knowing. If they are one and the same thing, then this would be how it would have to be. But the case here is that, when the dukkha vanished, this knowingness still remained. And even before this dukkha arose, the citta also knew. How can they be considered one and the same thing? we have to differentiate and set apart the presumption and assumption, the preconceived notions, and the suppositions of sannyā that allege and purport that this thing or that thing is dukkha. Then rounding them in and mixing them up until it turns out that these things are dukkha. The flesh is dukkha. The sinews are dukkha. The bones are dukkha. The heart is dukkha. In short, that we are dukkha. And when it gets to the point where we are dukkha, then it can be extremely painful and excruciating. We have to differentiate and analyze so that we can see it clearly as it is. This is one type of majjhima to be used in combating dukkha vetana that becomes extremely severe after we have sat for a long time or when we are afflicted with illness. This is especially so in the last moments when we are about to pass away. Then dukkha vetana will offer its full onslaught. It will come upon us to its maximum limit, to the extent where we may not be able to withstand it, but perish right there and then. Between this dukkha that is so severe that we are unable to withstand it and will have to pass away, and the dukkha that arises in practice, of these two types of dukkha, which is more severe? If we are not capable of coming to true realization and insight into the nature of dukkha, by doing the investigation at this time, how then can we come across true realization and insight into the nature of the dukkha vetana that arises at the time when we are about to pass away, when the dukkha is at its extreme limit? If our work of investigation is in vain at this time, then when we die, we will also be in vain. We will never be able to come up with any essence or substance to hold on to as our basis. But if we have investigated and come to true realization and insight into the nature of the dukkha vetana that appears, and all its parts like the skin, the flesh, the bones, and the sinews, that are all found within this body, and if we can see them clearly with panya, and know that the citta is the citta, and know each separate condition as being a separate truth in itself, and know dukkha vetana as it really is, and know each of these things as they really are, and as they have been perceived through the means of our investigation with panya, then it is possible for us to separate ourselves from them. Even if the dukkha doesn't come to cease and disappear, it will not be able to disturb and agitate the heart, or give the heart confusion and trouble. We can then remain at ease and comfortable. We will remain bold and courageous. We will remain with a shield protecting our heart. Each of these things are real. When they are each real, then they do not disturb one another. The body is merely the body. The vetana is merely the vetana. And the citta is merely the citta. They each are real. And this is how I myself was able to perceive them with sati and panya. This is one category of majjhima that we will have to apply in our practice. When the kilesas, tanha, and asava, and raka tanha are becoming very violent, then we will have to apply the means that is equally forceful and strong. We have to counter them with their opposites. We have to bring in the nimitta of asupa. We have to take the picture that is very pleasant and beautiful in front of us, and then we have to establish it to break down, decompose, and establish it so that it becomes bloated, becomes rotten, and then decomposes. Then being devoured by vultures, crows, and dogs, right in front of us. How then can there be any desire or infatuation? This is the way of the Majjhima. This is how you will have to understand it. You have to come up with a tool that is suitable for the different kinds of kilesa that exhibit themselves. No matter how vehement and violent, or how subtle they might be, we have to come up with the corresponding tools that can catch up with them, or else we will never be able to achieve our purpose. It is the same way with asupa. We have to do it in such a way that we can really catch up with the kilesas. We have to get to see them clearly within our hearts. We have to overwhelm and counter each different kind of kilesa with the corresponding kind of Majjhima. Then we will be able to live in peace and happiness. The Dhamma teaching of the Lord Buddha, which we call the Majjhima, is of many different levels or categories. When we have established bases within ourselves, then the Majjhima Patipada that we have utilized will now have to vary to suit the various kinds of kilesas that still exist, and which are far more subtle, until this Majjhima becomes flowing constantly, day and night, due to the work of the constant investigation. And when the kilesas become more subtle, then Panya will also become correspondingly more subtle. The things that will be capable of catching up with the kilesas are sati and panya. However, the kilesas manifest themselves. Sati and panya will always be able to catch up with them and be capable of outwitting them. You have to apply this sati and panya, and you have to really investigate, doing it thoroughly. Don't remain idle, doing nothing. Don't be weak or discouraged. Don't project difficulties into the future. Don't think that in the future it will be very hard to do the practice. If you want to think, then we should think that the kilesas will always be menacing and trampling over our heart in every form of existence that we will take up. This will go on ceaselessly if we cannot find a way of correcting them. They will be the ruler of the heart and subject it to take up birth in the various forms of existence following the karma that we have made in the past. We are being totally useless in allowing the kilesas to manage and damage ourselves. If we are going to think about the future, this is how we are going to have to think. It is only the present that is of any importance. We have to try to set up ourselves and be able to stand our ground and set up our resolve. We must not back down. The Lord Buddha had vouched for the efficacy and result of all the Dhamma that he laid down for us. He was the first one to cultivate this Dhamma and was able to attain to the fruit, going up steadily to the state of illumination, the state of Buddho, the state of purity, due to the influence of this Dhamma. The Lord had verified and tested this Dhamma before expounding it to us. So how can this Dhamma go off the mark? The Gilesas can never surpass this Dhamma. Every kind of Dhamma surpasses the Gilesas. Every kind of Dhamma outstrips every kind of Gilesa. If we apply the Dhamma so that it is suitable to each different type of Gilesa, then it is certain that we will be able to stamp out and overcome every kind of Gilesa. This is the fundamental principle that we have to think of and apply in our practice. We have to exert ourselves and be very vigorous and enterprising. We should not see anything to be more valuable than Dhamma, to the extent of being obsessed and engrossed in it, as being more valuable than the state of deliverance from the Gilesas and Asavas, which oppress the heart. This is a crucial point. To be totally free of all kinds of Gilesas is the happiness which we should aspire for, as this is the everlasting happiness. It is the happiness that is totally independent of time, the happiness that lasts forever. You have to set up your hearts and concentrate in your investigation. I teach my fellows in Dhamma wholeheartedly and with pure intention. I have not kept anything secret from you. I teach and bring to light the various means and methods in coping, conquering, and overcoming those influences that are inimical and antagonistic to the heart, from my personal and practical experience. I illustrate and point out all the facts and know-how of practice. Try to strive and set your heart into the practice. You must not relent in your exertion. Sati is terribly important. You must always try to maintain your sati. Don't be careless or unmindful. But when we come to association and involvement with one another, the tendency is for us to be absent-minded and to lose our guard. Like the time when we come to have our hot drink, or while we are walking along the path together, or when we have work to do together. We tend to be unmindful to the extent where we become carried away and become somewhat wild and reckless. Don't let this happen within the circle of the practitioner, who sees the harm of the Vata Sangsara and the harm of the Kilesas. While we are walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, while we are eating or drinking, we must always be seeing the harm of the Kilesas. Don't be immersed in the pleasure of eating. While standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, don't be immersed in reverie and fantasy, nor be heedless or negligent. For this is not the way of the Lord Buddha. This is not the way for one who is going to be free from dukkha. Remember this very well. Wherever you are, be possessed with sati. Don't be negligent or heedless. Be possessed with sati always. You must really and firmly establish your sati. Don't waste your time in thinking of and concocting up the things that you have done countless times before. All there is in this vata samsara and this entire world is just our thinking and concoction that disturbs and troubles our hearts. Haven't we seen the harm of them already? Why do we have to cherish them and be immersed in thinking about them? We should learn our lesson well from those things which have been harmful to us. Try to avoid and get away from that kind of thinking, and try to suppress and eradicate all those things that can be antagonistic to us, and which are the consequence of our thinking and concocting. Let us open up the way of thinking in the way of Dhamma, so that the Dhamma can appear. Then all the thinking process that goes in the way of Samudaya can gradually fade away. Then this other thinking process can spring forth, becoming truth and Dhamma, that is capable of overcoming the kilesas and asava. The citta that can steadily attain to calm is the result of our practice. Let us not put the blame on our vasana and endowments. The kilesas pay no attention to the endowments and vasana of anyone. Regardless of the numbers of the kilesas, they are always and all harmful to us. We have to look at the kilesas as the harm and as the bane. We must not think about those vasanas and endowments that can help us eradicate the kilesas, apart from our diligent effort and strenuous exertion, having sati and panya as our instrument. This is the crucial basis for the eradication and suppression of the kilesas. Don't be concerned with the vasanas and endowments, for this can only cause us to become weak and discouraged. Then we will not be able to make it through. We have to be tough and strong, we who are the practitioners. When I heard Thanajanman relate the way that he had exerted himself, I was moved with sympathy and compassion for him. For he was really earnest and serious, putting his whole life into it. He really sought for the truth and Dhamma, despite the fact that no one was there to teach and guide him. He kept on struggling and plowing through, doggedly, by himself, with the aid of the texts that were presented in general terms, and was eventually able to get through and become our wonderful teacher in this present generation. Before he could become famous and an honor to the sasana and be respected and venerated by the people, both those who had gone forth and the laity, he had to really struggle. He was really earnest and serious, really putting up his life in exchange for what he was looking for. It was this that enabled him to become wonderful and noble, and to be free from all forms of dukkha. No form of samuti could touch him any longer, from that very moment on to the end of time. This is what is meant by Nibbana is permanent. The kilesas are impermanent, for they are samuti, and they have both sukha and dukkha. There is gain and loss, and they lead people to be happy and sad. And this is the way they will always lead people. When we have corrected and overcome all of these things, then it is not necessary to say whether the citta is permanent or not, or whether nibbana is permanent or not. It is only the kilesas that infiltrate the citta, that make it have its ups and downs, highs and lows, constantly changing places and not remaining in equilibrium. It keeps changing from sukha to dukkha, from being luminous to being dull, to being confused and agitated, to being calm. These are all the disturbances of the kilesas. But when the kilesas calm down due to our exertion, then the heart also attains to calm. If our exertion becomes more intense, then our kilesas will get calmer and calmer. And when we can overcome any particular kind of kilesa, then that particular kilesa will disappear, and we will keep on overcoming and getting rid of every single kind of kilesa until there isn't a single one left within the heart. We will then not have to go and look for any happiness anywhere else. We can see very clearly that the reason that we cannot find any happiness is because of the kilesas that obstruct us, that pressurize and oppress us with affliction and dukkha. We have to shoulder the burden of this dukkha constantly, all of the time, in all the various forms of existence, right on up to the present one. But when we are totally free from this oppression of the kilesas, and they have been totally vanquished from the heart, then it is not necessary to ask about the equilibrium of the citta, the agalika citta, or the agalika dhamma, the timeless citta, or the timeless dhamma, or the dhammopadipo, the radiance of dhamma, that is constant and unchanging. We don't have to ask about these things, for they will be found within everyone. You must really strive in achieving this, for it is the most valuable treasure, much more precious than all the other possessions of the world that are highly cherished and valued. But there is also tremendous greed for them, a great desire to acquire them. Although one might already have these things, one still wants more of them. This is the way of lopa, the ambition for power and influence is also the work of the kilesas. Greed, or lopa, is the work of the kilesas. Hatred is the work of the kilesas. Delusion is the work of the kilesas, as well as the confusion and trouble of both the body and the heart. They are all the work of the kilesas. They are not the work of Dhamma. Although it might have to go through dukkha, the work of Dhamma is the work for happiness. This dukkha is the investment capital. The sukha is the profit that arises therefrom. This is not just simply going through the type of dukkha that is damaging and menacing without there being any reward, like the way the glaciers destroy people. This is the difference. This is how they differ. When we strive in our exertion, if there is dukkha, then let us face it, so long as the results are steadily forthcoming, and the heart is becoming blissful and joyful, until we arrive at perfection. Then all of our burdens will be shed off. The battle that has been raging against the kilesas, like a dhammacakka, turning around relentlessly and ceaselessly, both day and night, while walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, with the exception of the time when one goes to sleep. So intense will the contention with the kilesa have been, will immediately come to cease when all of our enemies have been totally vanquished. Then the instrument that counter the kilesas, or the mode of our practice that has been turning around like a revolving wheel, will also immediately come to cease. This is because all of the opposition and all of the enemies that one has been contending with have all totally disappeared. The battle of Dhamma between the kilesas and the citta has now come to a decisive conclusion. One has now attained to victory. The conquering of oneself, which is the conquering of the kilesas within one's heart, is far more supreme than conquering other people or winning battles 100,000 times. We have to accomplish this work. End of Desana.